Aisling pressed the palms of her hands into her face. She sat like that for what felt like a long time. She felt nauseous. The room was too hot. She needed to take off her jumper. Maud leaned towards Aisling across the table. Her hair fell around her face again as she spoke. It made her look younger. Aisling, he's not there. There's just no way it happened the way they say. She clicked a button on her laptop, rewound and replayed the video. They both watched the faces. Happy couples holding hands. Three girls, who looked like they were shivering, walked with arms linked, one of them holding out an arm to hail a taxi as they walked. A group of students, probably a bit the worse for wear, looked like they were singing a song as they walked out of the frame of the camera. Aisling felt herself shaking. She clasped both hands together and pressed her feet into the carpet. Maud was looking at her. "Are you okay?" she asked. Aisling wanted to say that she wasn't okay, that she didn't know how she felt about anything, except that she knew she'd fucked up. Jack had been hers. She'd loved him with everything she had known him better than anyone else. And yet she'd believed the story the police gave her with barely a question raised. She felt shame that she'd believed the suicide story, relief that it wasn't true. Release from the guilt she'd felt at failing him so badly, at missing signs she now thought hadn't been there to miss. Anger, because he was still dead, and she was still alone. "How could I have been so fucking stupid?" Maud shook her head slowly, but didn't say anything. She looked down for a long moment and took another sip from her wine glass, then closed the laptop. Aisling stood up and walked back to the window, pressed her forehead to the cool glass, and closed her eyes for a long moment. "Jack. Oh, Jack." Maud spoke from behind her. "You should know that this doesn't prove anything for sure. One side of the street only has a camera at one end, so strictly speaking, it is possible that Jack could have entered that end, and that the guy who made the call could have come in and left the same way." Aisling turned to face Maud, pulled a face and gestured towards the computer. "There's no way," she said. "There's no time. The police can't ignore this. They'll have to open an investigation." But Maud was shaking her head. "I already brought this to them. This afternoon, as far as they're concerned, this changes nothing." It was like Maud had hit her. She was 10 steps behind and reeling. She felt slow and stupid. Since Jack's death, she had been in a bad dream, and she wanted desperately to wake up. "What?" she said. "I saw Rogers. He didn't say very much, just 2 copies of the videos. He called me an hour later to say he'd looked them over, that they proved nothing. And Jack probably jumped from one of the other bridges, and the guy who made the call got the name wrong." "Jesus, I don't believe that," Maud said hurriedly. "I mean, I don't know if there are cameras, but we could look into it. I'm just trying to tell you that the police are not on our side. That guy Rogers, he's the kind who gets an idea in his head and won't let it go. It's all about him and his ego, and he's not likely to turn around and acknowledge that he was probably wrong. We're going to have to push hard. This footage is a beginning, but we'll need as much evidence as we can to contradict their conclusions. And we have to be willing to stir things up. Go to the media, maybe, if we can make this story sound compelling enough." Aisling nodded slowly. If someone killed Jack, what were they supposed to do? They weren't qualified, didn't have the resources. Aisling's vision started to swim, blackness creeping in at the edges. Her nausea intensified. "You think it was definitely a fake call, then? Not a mistake?" "Who makes a mistake about someone jumping into the river on the same night that a body is found in it? No way!" "I know, it's unlikely. Ludicrous, even, when it was put like that. But you're saying, the alternative is that someone killed him. Murdered him." Maud was watching her carefully, and Aisling, aware that her hands were still shaking, tucked them under her arms. "I don't know, Aisling. Maud said. You were his partner. Is there anything you can tell me? Anything at all in Jack's life that could lead to something like that? As she spoke, she stood and walked to the bed, picked up the phone and dialed. Soup all right?
I'm not hungry,
Aisling said automatically.
You don't look well, Maud said, like you might faint.
You're cool, but it might be better to eat. She waited for Aisling's nod, then placed an order for two. There was a calm assurance about Maud that made Aisling feel graceless, like an awkward schoolgirl playing at grown-ups. They talked about Jack while they waited. Not in a catching-up sort of a way, but a conversation about his typical movements, who his friends were, where he worked, what sort of work he did. Aisling was conscious that she was volunteering less and less as time wore on, until the conversation deteriorated into a question-and-answer session that made her feel like she was being interrogated and was making a shoddy witness. The food arrived, and the smell made her stomach clench in sudden hunger. She wasn't eating enough. Maud cleared the laptop and papers from the table and set out the bowls, glasses, and cutlery. She handed Aisling a napkin, put one in her own lap, and they ate in uncomfortable silence. The soup was exactly what Aisling needed. She felt her stomach settle and her energy return. When they'd finished, Maud set her bowl aside and waited.
I've been thinking about what you asked, said Aisling. About Jack. About whether there was anything in his life that could have brought him into contact with someone who would hurt him.
She spread her hands in a helpless gesture.
But there's nothing. I can't think of anything. I mean, I'm not saying that Jack was perfect. No one is perfect. But he was just Jack. Just an ordinary guy.
Jack was a civil engineer, for God's sake. He designed roads and bridges. He liked to be outside, loved to hike and climb. She could think of at least four other guys in their social circle alone that could fit that broad description.
He never got into any kind of trouble. Neither one of us did drugs. Jack didn't even drink.
You have to think harder, Aisling. There must have been something.
I can't make something up. People liked Jack. He never got into any kind of trouble.
When did you last see him?
In the morning. I had worked a night shift. We had breakfast together, then I went to bed. When I woke up, he was gone. We were supposed to have dinner together that evening, but Jack never came home. And the next morning, the Gardaí showed up at our door.
But you talked at breakfast?
Yes.
And?
Aisling rubbed her forehead with her hands. She wasn't going to go there. That conversation was private. And anyway, there was nothing in it that could have gotten Jack killed. Not if he hadn't done it himself.
Aisling, there must be something.
Maud was leaning forward now, dark eyes gleaming. She was so intense. Her energy almost frenetic. Aisling pushed her chair away from the table.
I can't tell you something I don't know. Honestly, I can't imagine that there is anything to tell. Maybe it was just an accident. The phone call a prank. That was just a coincidence. Maybe Jack did drink that night. Maybe he fell into the river. We're never going to know. And even if we did know, it's not going to bring him back.
She forced back tears she didn't want to shed.
Jack is dead, Maud. And nothing you or I do now will change that.
Well,
said Maud. She sat back. Her energy didn't dissipate. If anything, she seemed to gather it back in, to control it and to refocus herself.
You might be able to live with that. But I can't.
They sat in silence, the moments ticking by, and Aisling felt increasingly uncomfortable.
What about his messages?
Maud asked.
Sorry?
Did the police trace Jack's calls, his messages? If he had an arrangement to meet someone that day, something he hadn't told you about, maybe they called each other.
I don't know. It hadn't occurred to her to ask.
We need to follow up on that. And if they haven't done it, maybe the telephone company will release them to you as his next of kin.
Do they do that? Am I even his next of kin? We weren't married. Maybe they'd consider his parents.
Aisling shook her head. She couldn't see a phone company releasing someone's private messages to their bereaved parents, even a wife. Surely there'd be privacy considerations. And if they did release to the next of kin, Maud could probably get them more easily than she could. Aisling felt a strong reluctance to suggest that. The thought of Maud reading through Jack's messages made her distinctly uncomfortable. Don't you think this is something for the police? She raised her hands in a warding-off gesture. I don't mean that Rogers guy, obviously. But there are other police officers. They're not all incompetent, surely. Maud shrugged. The Gardaí have made their minds up about Jack. They won't do anything. They're just the same as social workers. If you push them, they go through the motions, file some forms, push some paper. They'll waste your time. They won't waste mine. Look, Maud, I don't know what you want from me. I'm a doctor, not some sort of investigator or vigilante. Aisling picked up her coat. You're a doctor. You must have connections at the coroner's office. Can you get the post-mortem results? There was an unspoken at least in that sentence and a hint of coldness, of distance in Maud's gaze. Was it because Aisling wasn't throwing herself head over heels down this rabbit hole? I'll do what I can, said Aisling. For Jack. Though she couldn't see what it would achieve. It would be a distraction from her grief and from the decision she now had to make alone. Tuesday, 26th of March, 2013. Chapter 10. By the following morning, Cormac had decided to attack the Blake case. If there was an agenda within the Gardaí, he didn't need to know what it was, at least not for now. He would work this case the way he would any other, follow the evidence wherever it led him. The only difference being that he didn't have a great deal of confidence it would lead anywhere. He started with the case file and was amused and a little embarrassed to read his own preliminary reports written as a 20-year-old rookie in 1993. Reading them with the benefit of 2 decades' experience, he could see his uncertainty all over the page. Everything was couched in possibilities and maybes, and his recommendation that a further investigation be carried out was tentative at best. Unfortunately, there was as little to work with as he had expected. The file contained only his report from the night he'd found the kids and Hilaria Blake's body, the post-mortem report, and interviews that were carried out with the neighbors and at the children's schools. He read the post-mortem carefully. In the pathologist's opinion, which was heavily couched with provisos, Hilaria Blake had not been a habitual heroin user. Testing had been less advanced in the 90s, of course, and hair analysis, which would have answered the question conclusively, would have been too expensive. Hilaria Blake had had advanced liver psoriasis and severe alcoholic hepatitis, but she had not been a heroin addict. She was jaundiced, had fluid buildup in her abdomen and legs. The marks he had seen on her arms had not been track marks, but almost certainly self-inflicted scratches. Psoriasis had led to an increased level of bile in her body, which would have made her skin intensely itchy. The pathologist was very clear on one thing. Hilaria Blake had end-stage liver disease. It would have killed her if the heroin hadn't got there first. Heroin overdoses were rare occurrences in 1993. The Blake's house was less than a mile from Kilmore Village, which had no known drug problem. And even in 1993, heroin was not a commonly used drug outside of Dublin and parts of Limerick. How had Hilaria Blake, an alcoholic, bedbound with advanced liver disease, procured just enough heroin to kill herself? Interviews in the village had not provided an answer. Hilaria had not been seen at the local pub or off-license in a year and a half or longer. Maud was known to shop at the local convenience place for food, but made no attempt to buy alcohol. In those days, the fact that she was underage wouldn't necessarily have prevented a sale. She wouldn't have been the first child sent to the village to buy a bottle of whiskey and bring it home to a parent. But the off-license owner had been adamant that he wouldn't have sold to her even if she had asked, and she never did. Cormac had spoken to him himself and had believed him. The village knew that Hilaria was a drunk, and they seemed to see Maud as a good, hard-working girl. They did nothing to help her, as far as Cormac could determine, but they drew a line at supplying the alcohol that was the root of the problem. He wondered if that minor act of civic responsibility had been a village-wide sop, something that freed them from the obligation to take any meaningful action to help the children. They wouldn't sell the family alcohol, and every now and again a teacher would make a token effort to get Maud to school. Other than that, the family was totally isolated. The only person known to spend time with the family was a local religious do-gooder, a woman who had not been terribly popular, but was hardly likely to be a supplier of alcohol or heroin. But when Cormac had tentatively raised his concerns with his boss, he had been ignored. There had been no desire to investigate the death of a woman who was widely known to have been an alcoholic who abused her children. Having seen the results of her abuse on poor Jack Blake's little body, Cormac himself had little sympathy for the woman. But the hypocrisy of it galled him. Now, 20 years later, the obvious questions were still unanswered. He turned to the statements from the schools. They'd interviewed the principal of the primary school and Jack's teacher, and the statements were consistent. Jack had been in junior infants and had only been at the school for a couple of months. Jack's mother never came to the school. His sister dropped him off every morning and collected him at the end of the day. Although he had a reasonable lunch with him most days, and he was generally clean and tidy, his teacher at the time had suspected that his mother was negligent. She'd seen a bruise on his wrist once, and another on his cheek, and had called social services. She'd heard nothing from them, and had expected nothing. Similar bruises on Maud had been reported more than once, and as far as the school was aware, nothing had been done. The principal of the secondary school had said that Maud had a very poor attendance record, and a report had also been made to social services about her continual absences. Again, nothing more had been heard, and Maud had continued to miss school until she turned 15, when she'd stopped attending entirely. Some of her teachers had said she was a bright girl, but she wasn't a mixer, and seemed to have few friends. Hilaria Blake had been seen by the school only at Maud's enrollment meeting, and never after that. There was nothing in the file to help him. He flicked through again, from the beginning to the end. Nothing from the social workers. Hadn't he requested the file? He thought back. Yes, he was sure he had, but he couldn't remember it coming in. He hadn't had long with the case. Within a few weeks of Hilaria's death, he'd been told to close it and move on. Cormac made a note to request the file again now. Cormac turned to Jack's discharge report from the hospital. He skimmed through the description of Jack's injuries. The last page had a brief narrative description of the treating doctor's recommendations for follow-up treatment, which included counseling, as well as a special diet to address nutritional deficiencies. Cormac was about to give up on the file when he saw that the hospital had kept track of Jack's visitors. Hospital protocol at the time? Perhaps just for children unaccompanied by a parent. The list was short, only two names. His own, and that of a Tom Collins. Cormac had come each of the 4 days that Jack was in hospital. Tom, whoever he was, had come twice, early on the first morning after Jack's admission, and again on the last day before he was discharged. The records were detailed. Arrival and departure times were noted. Cormac sat back in his chair and thought. Tom Collins had reached the hospital before 9 a.m. the morning after Jack's admission. If Maud had been telling the truth that night, she had called only the police after she had found her mother dead, which meant that Cormac had been the only person in the world, other than the children, who knew about Hilaria Blake's death until they'd reached the hospital and Cormac had called it into the station. And that had been late evening. So how had this Tom Collins known he would find 5-year-old Jack Blake in Castlebar General Hospital at 9 a.m. the following morning? Cormac stood and walked to the coffee station, rescued a teaspoon from the sink, made himself a coffee. Could be Collins was a friend of the family, with a connection to the Gardaí. If that was the case, he'd have heard the story fairly quickly. But that didn't feel right. If someone like that, someone with connections, had had a relationship with the family, surely something would have been done about the children. Cormac tried to think of other circumstances that could have led to such an immediate visit, and they all seemed a stretch. It wasn't much. But it was an inconsistency, and it was something, at least, to work with while he was waiting on the social worker file. He spooned sugar into his cup, looked around for biscuits to raid. Nothing. He was getting hungry. He took his coffee back to his desk, closed the paper file, logged into Pulse, and typed in a basic search. Tom Collins, Kilmore. He didn't expect to get a hit, and was surprised when the system kicked out a long list of results. He scanned them quickly. He hadn't limited his search in any way, and the system had found a series of criminal cases where the defending solicitor was a man named Thomas Collins, with addresses in Kilmore and Galway. The entries didn't give a date of birth. Cormac turned to Google, which gave him very little information. Tom Collins, it seemed, was a relatively private person. No public Facebook profile for him. A little poking about led to a short profile piece in an industry magazine. Apparently, Thomas had been chair of the Free Legal Advice Clinic in Galway 2 years before. He was quoted in the piece as saying that he himself had grown up in less than affluent circumstances. He'd been in and out of foster homes as a child, he said, and that he was a firm believer in giving back. The piece had a little sidebar which listed the schools and university he had attended, as well as his age. Thomas Collins was 35, the same age as Maud Blake. He'd also attended Kilmore Secondary School. It seemed more likely than not, then, that Tom Collins had been a friend of Maud's. Had she called him that night? Asked him to visit Jack? As Cormac stared at his computer screen, lost in thought, Rogers heaved himself into the chair to his left and opened a family-sized packet of cheese and onion potatoes. That was enough. Cormac stood, grabbed his coat, and left. An interview with Tom Collins would have to be his start. Chapter 11. The practice, Collins, Barber and Associates, was on Abbeygate Street, right in the middle of the city and a short walk from the courthouse. Cormac walked there from Mill Street and had no difficulty finding the place. The offices were on the first floor, directly above a cafe that advertised toasted cheese and ham sandwiches with coffee for €10, on a blackboard placed on the path. His stomach growled. Maybe on the way back out, if he got what he came for. The door opened directly onto an uneven staircase that looked circa 1900 and probably needed some structural work. The steps were canted oddly and creaked alarmingly when Cormac climbed them two at a time. They led to a small reception area, a pleasant sort of place, despite the general shabbiness. The reception desk had seen better days, and there was a musty smell that might have been coming from an open filing cabinet that ran from floor to ceiling and covered the entire wall behind the reception desk. The mustiness was almost masked by the smell of coffee from the cafe downstairs, and every surface in the small room was exceptionally neat. The receptionist was a young guy in his early 20s. He had an earpiece in one ear and was typing furiously. He gave Cormac a tortured-looking nod, which Cormac took to mean he had been seen and would be dealt with in a moment. After another full minute of furious typing, the receptionist let out a sigh and looked up. "Sorry," he said. "The rewind button is broken, so if I don't get it all down first time, I have to listen to it all again from the beginning." He spoke with a strong Cork accent.
"Right," said Cormac, bemused. "Is Thomas Collins available? I'm Detective Sergeant Riley. I'd appreciate a few minutes of his time."
The young man picked up the phone and pressed a button. "Tom, there's a DS here for you." He paused. "Well, yeah, first go. But I have to go through now and fix the typos." He hung up and smiled at Cormac. "He'll be with you in 5, he said. Cormac had barely sat down when an office door opened, and a tall man in a shirt and tie walked towards him, a coffee cup in one hand, and holding out the other to be shaken.
"Detective?"
he asked. At Cormac's nod, he gestured to a door just off the reception area.
"I haven't much time, unfortunately. Case conference in 15 minutes, but perhaps we can be brief."
He waited for Cormac to open the door, which led to a meeting room, and then followed him in. The room felt cluttered, the table too big for it, and the chairs not quite fitting comfortably. Collins shut the door behind him, but neither man sat, which left them both standing awkwardly in the uncomfortably small space.
I'd like to speak with you about your friend, Maud Blake.
Collins's expression, until then a mask of professional civility, registered surprise.
What? Maud? Is she okay? You're still in touch?
Cormac asked.
I thought this was about a case.
He let his voice trail off.
Never mind.
He pulled out a chair and gestured to Cormac to sit.
Take a seat, detective.
Cormac sat. The conference table was an antique and not very practical. It was too low for comfort, and one of the table legs was directly in front of the seat he had taken.
You're still in touch with Maud?
Cormac asked again.
From time to time,
Collins said.
An occasional email. Recently?
Collins had recovered his composure.
I called her a week or so ago to let her know that her brother Jack had passed away. I couldn't reach her, so I sent an email. I haven't heard from her since, so I don't know whether or not she got my message.
As Collins spoke, Cormac reached into his pocket and took out a notebook. He turned to a blank page and started taking notes, Collins watching him all the while.
So, you knew Jack Blake?
Cormac asked, the question delivered as casually as possible, not looking up from his notebook.
I knew him as a child, said Collins. I haven't kept in touch. But you knew he had passed away.
Collins shrugged.
It was reported in the newspapers. The Galway Advertiser ran a feature on the front page, if I recall correctly. We've had a spate of suicides by young men recently, more than one in the river. And you were sure, just from the name in the paper, that it wasn't another Jack Blake? Sure enough to call his sister?
Collins raised one eyebrow.
Not from around here then, detective?
He asked. His tone was gently chiding.
Galway might be a city of 80,000, but everyone knows everyone. I wasn't in touch with Jack, but I had a vague idea of where he was living, and I knew that he was in a relationship. A friend of a friend knows his girlfriend.
Cormac nodded and resumed taking notes, slowly and methodically. It was an old habit when interviewing witnesses. Most people felt a certain anxiety during the silence. Sometimes they felt compelled to fill it. Collins didn't, but Cormac hadn't really expected it of him. A defense lawyer with his kind of experience would certainly be more self-controlled.
So you haven't seen Maud then, recently?
Cormac asked. Collins shook his head.
She's back in Ireland. She got my message. She's back in Galway. I don't know if she got your message.
Then, turning a new page in his notebook,
did you know Jack well? As I told you, detective, I knew Jack only as a child, and knew a little about him through friends.
Collins's tone was cool, but betrayed no irritation at the repeated question.
What is this about?
Cormac looked up from his notebook, his expression bland.
A death in suspicious circumstances, Mr. Collins. We would be remiss if we did not investigate before the inquest. In case there is any suggestion that it was something other than a suicide.
After his initial surprise, Collins had become difficult to read. He didn't react to Cormac's statement, but Cormac had to assume he was too smart to accept it at face value.
Jack Blake was adopted, Mr. Collins. You were aware?
Collins nodded. Cormac made a show of consulting his notebook.
His mother died when he was 5, as I understand it, and other than his sister, he had no family. There has been a suggestion, too, that his mother may have been neglectful of Jack and his sister, perhaps even physically abusive. Do you know anything about that?
Collins laughed, but the sound was constrained, not natural.
I know that Hilaria Blake was very beautiful and very damaged when she moved to Kilmore. She had a problem with the drink even then, but things accelerated very fast once they moved into that house. She was a terrible mother. In what way? Neglectful. She got lost in her own pain, had nothing left for her children. She was violent.
A hesitation.
To the children? No.
Tom shook his head.
She didn't hit them. No.
Simple. Firm. Would Tom have known about the abuse? Perhaps Maud had wanted to protect her mother, keep it a secret.
But she was neglectful. In the last couple of years, she stopped pretending to provide any kind of care at all. Maud did everything. What about family services? They weren't involved?
Depends on what you mean by involved.
They might have kept the file open, but by the time Maud and I were close, they had stopped visiting. No care visits, no case reviews. They abandoned the family entirely.
Cormac said nothing but raised an eyebrow. Colin sighed. He leaned forward, putting his elbows on the table and looked directly at Cormac. He spoke deliberately.
As I've said, in the early years it wasn't as bad, but in the last year or so before Hilaria's death, Maud stopped feeling like she could leave Jack alone with her mother. She walked him to school in the morning and she was waiting at the gate when school finished. Maud fed him, washed him, read to him. You know she was only 10 when he was born.
Cormac shook his head, meaning, he supposed, that of course he knew, but hadn't really considered it. Collins continued.
I suppose Hilaria was able to manage to some degree when Jack was a baby, but by the time he was 3, Maud started missing school. The following year, Maud would have been 14. She barely went at all. The day she turned 15, she stopped coming entirely. By then, she had a job working for a neighbor, doing a bit of cleaning, gardening, that sort of thing. She was paid next to nothing, but she needed the money to feed herself and Jack. As I said, her mother had pretty much given up any pretense of trying during those last couple of years.
Cormac put his notebook down.
Look, there were social workers available. If it was that obvious to everyone that Maud and Jack were neglected, why didn't they step in?
Collins leaned back.
You'd have to ask them, Detective. I was too young to know better at the time, to know that something should have been done. We none of us had reason to respect or trust the authorities at that stage of our lives.
Cormac thought about asking about the magazine piece, the foster homes, but he didn't want to lose the train of his questioning. He was already straying off track. He opened his mouth to ask another question, but the door opened and the receptionist stuck his head in. Broderick's running late, he said. We'll be another 15 at least. Without waiting for acknowledgement, he disappeared again and shut the door.
He has an unconventional manner, your assistant.
Cormac couldn't quite hold back the comment, but Collins was unruffled.
He's an apprentice, has a first-class law degree from Trinity. Not sure if he'll make it as a lawyer, to tell you the truth. Too honest.
The look Collins gave Cormac told him that he knew that Cormac hadn't told him the truth, that he knew that Cormac was playing a game, and that, unlike his apprentice, Collins knew the rules of this game and could play it as hard as anyone. Cormac liked him for it, despite himself. Defense lawyers were generally not his favorite people.
Do you know if the Blakes had any other family in the area, or any that would come and visit?
Collins shook his head, took a careful sip of his coffee.
Not that I'm aware of. Maud had a father, some sort of artist or writer her mother had lived with for a time, I think in London, although I might have that wrong. Maud never met him. I don't think anyone knew who Jack's father was. Their grandparents on their mother's side were dead. I never heard of any aunts or uncles. Any close family friends?
Cormac asked. Collins twisted his lips in a semblance of a smile.
Not within the normal meaning of the word, no.
He said.
By which you mean?
Cormac asked, but Collins shook his head, sipped his coffee. After a long pause, Collins said,
Hilaria didn't have friends. She didn't socialize. I don't know what sent her over the edge. Certainly she'd been abusing alcohol for years, but when she came to Kilmore, she attacked drink with complete single-mindedness. Maud told me she hadn't always been like that, but by the time I knew her...
Collins paused, his lip curling in unconscious disgust.
By the last 6 months, she rarely got out of bed. She looked like she was rotting there.
So he had seen her, had been in the house.
If Hilaria Blake wasn't capable of moving about, how did she continue to buy alcohol, collect her dole money? She must have been able to get about from time to time, at least every couple of weeks,
Cormac said. He paused.
Unless Maud got it for her. Maud would never have bought alcohol for her,
Collins said,
and Maud never got her hands on the dole money, at least not directly.
Cormac raised an eyebrow and lifted his notebook in one hand, as if to refer Collins to everything that had been said so far.
Then who?
He asked. Tom Collins was watching him carefully, weighing him up, it seemed, as he considered his answer. In the end, he tilted his head slightly to the left and spoke.
You haven't read the file, have you, Detective?
He asked. Cormac thought for a second he was referring to the police file, and the confusion must have shown in his eyes.
The social worker file, Collins said.
Cormac hesitated, but decided there was no advantage to hiding the truth from Collins.
If you could tell me about it from your perspective, that would be helpful, he said. So, you haven't read it?
There was no judgment in Collins' voice.
You should, you know. You might gain a little understanding, although you probably don't need to read it to guess what had happened. It would be helpful if you could...
Collins cut him off.
Consider, Detective, so far in this lovely story we have alcohol abuse and apathetic social workers. There's only one thing missing, isn't there? To round out the classic Irish Trinity?
Collins sat back in his chair, knitting his fingers behind his head.
I'm afraid you'll have to enlighten me.
Collins spoke deliberately, enunciating each word slowly.
The Holy Catholic Church, Detective. What else? I'm sorry? A version of it. A cultish little offshoot led by a woman called Dominica Keane.
Collins must have seen recognition in Cormac's eyes.
Yes, the lovely Mrs. Keane. I see you've heard of her.
Cormac searched his memory. The name was familiar, but he couldn't recall why. Collins helped him out.
She was a religious nut, crazy about Catholicism, or at least her version of it. I don't understand, said Cormac. This woman, Keane, she looked after the children? Hilaria Blake? No, said Collins. She didn't look after the children, though Maud worked for her. Dominica had had a small dairy farm. She hired casual farm laborers when she needed them. But she took Maud, too.
From the reception area, Cormac heard a sudden burst of noise, a deep bass voice introducing himself in a tone of self-importance that carried through the wall, the assistant's response, then conversation. Collins checked his watch.
That's probably my postponed case conference, he said. I can't put it back. The barrister's in court again after lunch. Mr. Collins, are you suggesting that Mrs. Keane supplied alcohol to Hilaria Blake?
Collins shrugged.
I'm not suggesting it, I'm stating it. She kept Hilaria Blake stocked with enough booze to float a boat. Why would she do that?
Collins glanced towards the reception area, then back at Cormac.
You'd have to ask her, and I'm sorry, Detective, but I have an appointment now.
He held the door expectantly, waiting for Cormac to get up and leave. Cormac took his time closing his notebook and standing.
I'd like to talk to you again, Mr. Collins.
Collins looked like he was considering it, his head tilted to the side once again.
What's this really about, Detective? I'm sorry? Why are you asking me questions about Hilaria Blake? She's been dead for 20 years.
Cormac said nothing. He knew Collins wouldn't believe that he was looking into Jack's background in this level of detail because of the suicide. There was no reason for the police to want to understand every aspect of Jack's past. As his childhood was well documented, it didn't really warrant further investigation. An inquiry into Jack's suicide would have focused on any signs of depression or other issues in his adult life.
Just one more question, Mr. Collins, if you can spare the time.
Cormac didn't wait for Collins to respond.
You're sure that Hilaria Blake could not, did not, leave her home in the last months of her life? You're not here about Jack,
said Collins flatly.
Questions have been raised about Jack Blake's death, specifically as to whether it was suicide or something else. Questions have been raised. By whom, exactly?
That information is not your concern, Mr. Collins.
Okay, so there are questions about Jack's death. That doesn't explain what you were doing here, asking me questions about his family life 20 years ago. Questions about Jack Blake's death inevitably lead us to look into his family background. Right.
Collins was not convinced.
Well, I've answered your questions, Detective, and I'm out of time.
He stood, put his hand on the door handle, waited for Cormac to stand.
Just one more question, Mr. Collins,
Cormac said.
The morning after Hilaria Blake's death, you visited Jack Blake in the hospital in Castle Bar.
He watched Collins' face intently. You were there by 9 a.m. that morning.
Colin's face was impassive. How did you know that Jack Blake would be in hospital that morning? How did you know where to find him? Collins waited a beat, but no more.
Really, Detective, it was 20 years ago and I was 15 years old. I can hardly be expected to remember.
And with that, he turned and walked out of the room.
Chapter 12. Three people had been in the house the night that Hilaria Blake died. Two of them were dead, and the third, it seemed, was the suspect. But if Jack had spoken to anyone about his mother and sister, it would surely have been his girlfriend. Jack Blake's last known address was in the system. He'd start there. A house in the Cladda, walking distance. Cormac was hungry, but not in the mood to stop for food. He bought coffee from a place on Dominic Street and sipped as he walked. Tom Collins had told him very little that he didn't already know, or at least should have known. He needed those social worker files. He put a call through to Children and Family Services, dialing one-handed. He got a receptionist who asked for his name before taking what felt like another 10 minutes to come back and tell him that no one was available to speak with him.
"We're amalgamating," she said, "with the Family Support Agency and the National Education Welfare Board. Everyone's at a workshop."
Her tone was upbeat, almost chattily helpful. He left a request for an urgent callback, was irritated, and chided himself for his impatience. He would have to wait for the information he wanted. Workshop or no workshop, a request for a 20-year-old file was never going to take priority with a bunch of overextended social workers. He'd certainly requested the file back in the day. Cormac tried to remember. He'd moved on to other work, traffic duty and pub raids mostly, but he'd been working in the same station. If the files had come in, wouldn't he have known? If they had come in, there would have been copies, and they should still be on the file. If they hadn't come in, someone should have followed it up, and a note of that action should be on the file also. Instead, there was nothing. Maybe he should have tried harder to continue working on the case. It wasn't as though Jack Blake had been easy to forget. That night in the hospital had been the first time Cormac had come face to face with a child who had been badly hurt by someone they should have been able to trust. How a mother could hurt her child like that was beyond him. Some of the things he'd seen since should perhaps have made Jack Blake's circumstances seem less appalling. But it didn't work like that. There was no grade curve for child abuse. The more time Cormac spent with this case, the more convinced he was that there were questions to answer. Even as a rookie, instinct had told him there were layers he wasn't seeing, that there was a story he hadn't heard. Maybe he'd get to the truth this time. Maybe he owed that much to Jack. Jack's address brought him to a terraced two-story house on the Cladda. The terraces had been labourers' cottages once, but their proximity to town and the sea had made them fashionable, and many had been renovated. Most were painted pastel colours that were a little sickly up close, but from a distance had a cheerful, seaside appearance. Number 43 was painted a deep blue, in pleasing contrast to the pastel shades. The blinds in the ground floor window were drawn. Cormac searched for a doorbell, rang, then knocked loudly. He waited for a minute or two before trying again. The front door was glass, and through it could be seen a little enclosed front porch, with a second solid wooden door inside that led into the rest of the house. Cormac could see two pairs of well-worn runners inside the porch. They must have been Jack's. They were too big to be his girlfriend's, and an umbrella propped in the corner. He stepped back. There was no sign of life at the first floor either. The curtains in the windows were open, but the rooms were dark. The policeman in him was distracted by the way the little porch roof provided perfect access to the first floor window above it, which was slightly ajar. If she wasn't home, her approach to home security left a lot to be desired.
"You looking for Aisling?"
He turned to see a woman at the neighboring terrace, paused in the act of locking her front door. She was examining him carefully, perhaps warily. He nodded.
"Yes."
"She'd be at work."
The woman leaned down to take the hand of her little boy and turned to go.
"Can you tell me where exactly?"
Cormac asked.
She hesitated. I'm a Garda, a detective. I'm acting as a liaison of sorts in relation to her partner's death. I'd like to speak with Aisling, but our file doesn't seem to have up-to-date contact information.
Cormac gave the woman a rueful smile that invited her to join him in a critique of bureaucratic ineptitude.
Have ye ID?
She wasn't impressed. She held her hand out.
Each terrace had a tiny walled front garden. The wall came to knee height only, just enough to give a suggestion of privacy between the front windows and the public footpath. The wall was low enough to step over, but Cormac stayed on his side as he moved closer, holding out his badge for her to see. She looked it over carefully, taking her time. At last, seemingly satisfied, she stepped back.
She works at UCHG, at the hospital. If you ask for her at the A&E reception, they'll send her out to you, if she's not too busy.
Thanks. Appreciate your help.
She nodded, but didn't return his smile, and he wondered if she'd had a bad experience with police. He watched her walk towards the seaside for a moment, holding tightly to her little boy's hand. He trailed behind her, and after a moment his mother scooped him up and carried him on her hip. The little boy slung his hand around the back of her neck and rested his head against her shoulder. Cormac watched them for a long moment before turning to walk back towards town. He would pick up his car before heading to the hospital. 20 minutes later, he was regretting his impulse to drive. The hospital car park was full, the entrance ramp already clogged with cars waiting for others to leave. He cursed and drove 100 meters or so from the entrance, parking in a 15-minute bay. A ticket, at least, he could take care of. It was a Tuesday afternoon, and accident and emergency was, as usual, busy. He walked over to reception and took out his ID.
Aisling Conroy, please. Is she here?
The nurse was completing a form, and after a brief glance at him, she returned to it, ticking boxes until she reached the end of the page. Finally, without making eye contact, she gave the ID a cursory once over.
She's with patients. Take a seat, and I'll let her know you're here.
He sat for 40 minutes before Aisling finally appeared. Her hair was tied back, and she wore a white long-sleeved T-shirt under her pale green scrubs. She looked tired. There was a sickly tinge to her skin, and far too young to be a doctor. She glanced around distractedly for a moment, then the receptionist gestured in Cormac's direction, and she walked over to him.
I'm Dr. Conroy, she said. You're a Garda?
Yes, a detective.
This is about Jack?
He nodded.
Okay, she said.
She looked at the waiting room, visibly rejected the idea.
There's a canteen if you'd like to get some coffee.
He nodded his assent, and she led the way to a small canteen in the basement. She offered to order, but he insisted, and she found a table for them while he bought 2 cappuccinos and carried them over.
Thanks for this, he said, for taking the time.
She shrugged.
Of course.
Is your shift over?
No.
She checked her watch. I'm afraid I only have 10 minutes. It was odd that she was working again so soon after her partner's death. It had barely been, what, a week and a half?
I'm following up on a few things, and I wanted to speak to you particularly.
She waited.
I understand that Maud Blake has some concerns about the investigation into Jack's death, that she doesn't believe it was accidental or that he committed suicide. I'm sorry, I know this must be very difficult to talk about, but I wanted to speak to you, to get your thoughts.
She stared at him. When she finally spoke, it was with a slow, measured tone.
I think what anyone would think, given what Maud has discovered. I think that there is a very good chance that someone killed Jack and threw his body into the river. The murderer then called the police and reported a jumper to make it seem like Jack killed himself.
I can understand why you might think that,
Cormac said, speaking carefully and worrying that he sounded condescending.
But there is more than one explanation for the confusion around the telephone call. The call didn't come in on the emergency line, and it wasn't recorded. It is possible that the person who made the call, or the person who took the call, mixed up the names of the bridges. It is possible that they were reporting a jump from a bridge further up the Corrib, and they confused themselves.
He was interrupted by a loud beeping noise. Aisling took a pager from her pocket and checked the number, then silenced it. He was reconsidering his initial impression of her. She was young, but there was an unusual self-assurance about her, here on her home turf. And have you checked the CCTV footage for the other bridges?
I'm sure my colleagues are on that.
Are you?
I'm not.
Maud told me that guy Rogers made it very clear that you are not going to investigate, that you're not going to ask any questions or check the other bridges, or do anything at all, in fact. Her eyes were guarded. Cormac was silent for a long moment. He couldn't and shouldn't make a commitment to her about any further investigation. It wasn't his case, and besides, Danny was probably right. Jack had almost certainly committed suicide. Raising expectations of a different conclusion would only lead to pain in the long run. And in the short term, for that matter. Who had ever hoped that their loved one had been murdered, after all? I wanted to ask you about Jack's sister.
About Maud?
Yes, do you know her well?
She sighed and rubbed tired eyes with the back of one hand.
I only met her a week ago. I don't know her at all.
You hadn't met her before?
No.
She and Jack weren't close.
As far as I know, she disappeared the day after their mother died, and she never called him or saw him again. He never spoke to her. In all honesty, I think he thought she was dead, although he didn't speak about her much. Cormac saw that she had tears in her eyes, and he looked at his notebook as he asked his next questions.
Did she tell you why she went? Why she didn't come back?
No.
She didn't talk about her childhood, about Jack.
Aisling looked impatient. We spoke about his death, about the manner of his death. It wasn't the time for happy reminiscence.
But you know that Jack was abused as a child.
Cormac asked the question bluntly. He wanted to cut to the chase, and he was forming the impression that she might be more comfortable with straight talk. She nodded slowly.
He told you.
He had scars on his body, from cigarette burns, other incidents.
You never talked about it?
Once, only. A long time ago. Jack had left it behind him. He barely remembered those years. He was only 5 when his birth mother died. He had nightmares for the first year, then that got better, then Jack got happy. And he didn't look back.
He told you about the nightmares?
She shook her head, took a sip from her coffee. No. His mother, his adoptive mother, that is, Aggie, told me.
Aggie.
He asked for her name and address and got it.
Aisling, Cormac said. What did Jack tell you about Maud? Were they close as children?
As he asked the question, Cormac flashed back to the night 20 years before, to the pale girl holding tightly to her little brother's hand. He thought of the way she had carried him to the squad car, how she had put on his seatbelt for him, how she had held his hand all the way to the hospital. Every instinct told him that Maud would never have hurt Jack. But instinct had been wrong before, so he would ask the question. He had very few memories of her, just vague feelings, really.
Positive or negative?
Aisling's eyes went to his.
Positive. He loved her. And she loved him. You sound very sure of that. But if Jack didn't remember much...
Before she could answer, the beeper went off again. Again, she checked the number. Again, silenced it. I don't know. Jack had very few memories of his early childhood. But he remembered being afraid, and he remembered how it felt to be hungry all day. He said he used to climb into Maud's bed to feel safe at night, and she would let him stay. He had a pair of Spider-Man pajamas. They were the only thing he brought to his new family, and he had them for years, he said. He said that Maud had bought them for him. Someone must have told him, I suppose, or he just remembered. God knows where she got the money. Tears had filled her eyes as she spoke. One rolled down her cheek, and she brushed it away absently. Poor Jack. Cormac handed her the napkin that had come with his coffee, and that he hadn't yet touched. He looked away for a few seconds, giving her a moment to compose herself.
Jack's memories of the abuse, were they specific?
Specific? I mean, did he remember any detail? Where he was when it happened? Who he was with?
Aisling shook her head.
He was only 5 when he was adopted, and his adoptive parents were wonderful. As I've said, Jack didn't dwell on the past.
I understand, Cormac said. But he was clear that it was his mother who hurt him. No one else.
Aisling took a moment to react, then a look of understanding spread across her face.
Are you asking me if Maud hurt him?
She asked.
Her voice was cool, but there was no mistaking her hostility.
He felt slightly off balance.
I'm not suggesting that, he said, just trying to understand all of the background.
I'm not sure how what happened to Jack when he was 5 years old has bearing on his death at the age of 24, she said.
Cormac sipped from his coffee, grasping for something he could use to redirect the conversation.
Don't try to tell me that the abuse Jack suffered in his childhood caused him to commit suicide. Jack wasn't depressed. He wasn't suicidal. You're just looking for an easy label.
I assure you, Aisling, that is not the...
She cut him off.
You can call me Dr. Conroy.
She snapped the words out.
Why is it so bloody difficult to do a bit of work? To get up and do the bloody investigation, to find out what happened. Why are you lot putting so much time and effort in to avoid time and effort? I'm sure Maud was wrong, that you would investigate properly once you saw the CCTV, but you've no intention of it, have you?
She stood up, her chair scraping along the floor. He made an attempt to hold her attention.
It's impossible to know at the beginning of an investigation which details are relevant and which are not. Sometimes it's the smallest hint of information that can lead you to answers.
She looked down at him, hesitated, but then her eyes hardened and she shook her head.
You know what, detective? I think you're full of shit.
She started to move away. He needed to hold her, needed her to trust him.
I was there that night,
he said. She turned.
The night Hilaria Blake died. I was wet behind the ears, first week on the job. They weren't expecting a body, there was some sort of mix-up, so they sent me.
She was holding on to the back of the chair, her eyes fixed on his.
I found Maud, found Jack, in a house with no electricity, damp everywhere, the place basically rotten around them. Their mother was dead. I brought them to the hospital. I saw what had been done to Jack. I never forgot him, Aisling.
And that, at least, was true.
I cared about Jack. I care about him now. If there's something suspicious about his death, I'll find out. But I need you to talk to me. If you hear something, know something, come and find me. I won't let you down.
Her eyes were still on his, weighing up his words, sifting them for truth. She gave him a single reluctant nod before walking away. Chapter 13. Aisling's hands were shaking as she walked away from the canteen. She pushed them deep into her pockets and lengthened her stride. She was working an A&E shift. The missed bleeps were from the surgical floor, which she wasn't even covering. But wasn't that what she had wanted? What she'd actively encouraged? She'd wanted to be the one the nurses sought out because they trusted her judgment and knew she was reliable. To be the one that consultants wanted on their service, because if they brought her in for a surgery, they knew that she would double-check the consents, the blood tests, that she would follow up on every patient, stay through the night if necessary. This reputation was why her surgical logbook was full, why she had performed 4 appendectomies where her peers had only performed 1 or 2, why she'd assisted on more complex surgeries than every other surgical trainee in the hospital. For the first time, she felt that she might have created expectations that she couldn't meet. Maybe Mary had been right. Maybe she had come back too early. Missing even a week meant that she had no context for half the patients on the wards. Surgeons seemed to forget or not be aware that she hadn't been present for recent surgeries. And her memory wasn't performing the way it should and always had. The neat little rows of numbers and connections she usually maintained in her head were a fragmented mess. Worst of all, and so terrifying that she couldn't bring herself to think about it, was the shake in her hands.
Mary was working on charts when Aisling reached the A&E desk. Aisling went straight to the phone and dialed surgery. She was conscious of Mary watching her as she spoke to a surgical nurse. Cummins had called in. He wanted bloods on a patient for the morning rounds. They hadn't been done, and the patient wasn't fasting. The patient didn't want to fast. Could Aisling come? Yes, she would be there in 5, if A&E could spare her. She hung up, turned to Mary, who had heard enough to get the gist.
I won't be long, Aisling said. You'd beat me if something comes in?
Mary didn't say anything. Something about the expression on her face held Aisling where she stood. Then, Mary reached into a pocket, took out a folded piece of paper, and handed it to her. It was a test result. Her test result. The one she'd submitted under a false name.
It's none of my business, I know,
Mary said, looking away from Aisling and down the corridor to where a cleaner was pushing a low-humming floor polisher, the machine gliding from side to side in a steady arc.
No, it really isn't.
Aisling paused.
Where did you find it?
You dropped it. When you were rushing the other day to meet his sister, I picked it up. Meant to file it for you, couldn't find the file. Figured it out.
Right.
She should walk away. Go straight upstairs, shut the conversation down, and never let it be reopened.
Do you want to talk about it?
No. Definitely not. But she still didn't move.
Aisling, you can tell me to fuck off if you want to, Mary said. I'm not going to be offended, and we can pretend we never had this conversation if that's what you want. But Jesus, you have a lot to lose. Anyway, I just thought I'd offer in case you needed someone to talk to about your options.
Mary turned back to her charts again, as if wanting to give Aisling privacy to consider her offer.
What sort of person kills their dead boyfriend's baby?
The words were out before Aisling had a chance to recall them, and Mary's expression was so kind that she couldn't bear it and had to look away.
Is that what you really think?
Mary asked.
That an abortion would be killing Jack's baby.
Aisling shook her head, her lips compressed.
You're what, no more than 6-7 weeks?
You know as well as I do,
Aisling said, with a gesture towards the test result.